This is hour 88.
With the Ninja Consultant Marathon.
The Ninja Consultant 100th Anniversary Podcast. Please kill me.
It's a podcast-a-thon. No, this is probably episode 93 of Ninja Consultant, where...
Not a real episode.
It's all real episodes, because you're on them, right? You're on one right now.
I'm only on them because you're putting me in the intro. That doesn't count.
Oh, fine. Another
Carol Surratt says it doesn't count.
Right. Another episode of Ninja Consultant freaking doesn't count. In this episode, this is a recording of Ed Chavez's panel called Sane and Up from Genericon 2011. And I only got to stay through half of the panel before I had to give a panel myself. So it's only part of it. The recording is not great. And Ed kind of rambles, but there's a lot to be learned.
Yeah, actually, this was a really good panel, and
I was bored to tears.
Disappointed that there were not more people in the audience. I know there were people at the convention who really should have been there and weren't. So
like
now I guess
Evan
they can.
Minto.
I thought Evan Minto made it to this one.
Did he?
Did he not? Was he? I think I really recall him being in the room.
Maybe.
But yes, he is someone who should listen to this if he hasn't already heard it.
Oh, because I've been podcasting, like, the 50 manga recommendations and stuff, like, out of context. I didn't really intro it enough to say, like, I don't think we talked about Genericon on the show. When we went to Genericon, we found that it was not actually an anime convention, but kind of a general gaming, sci-fi, and also anime and manga played a big part of it convention.
Possibly indicated by the name.
Yes, Genericon. At an engineering college, primarily. Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute.
Yep. Upstate New York.
Right. So when we gave the unusual manga genres panel or the manga recommendations panel, what was really... No, the unusual manga genres panel, what got a really big laugh was the Ubuntu?
Yeah, Ubuntu.
The Ubuntu manga. Because they were all engineers. So my manga panels and also Ed's Seinen panel that are coming up, they were sort of like... They're aimed at kind of experts of people who already know a lot about anime and manga. And I have given it, well, I mean, I've given the Unusual Manga Genres panel like a couple times at Anime Boston. And each time I give it, like someone would come up after the panel and be like, this is my first con. I don't know that much about manga and I learned so much from your panel. Yeah, Otakon, I get the feeling like that's the regional, I like to call it like chieftains of their local anime tribe always attend Otakon, so it's like a, you know, heads of tribes gathering. So at Otakon, like, people in the audience knew a lot about manga and were already familiar with some of the weirder stuff, but not all of them. There was also that girl at Manga Next who came up after the panel and was like, after Unusual Manga Genres, and was like, yes, I knew all of them.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, she also likes crazy
kids. Yeah, that's really good.
She showed up early, too, and sat in the front row.
There's
awesome.
No shame in that. There should be one person like that in every panel.
True. But what I'm saying, like, about this Sane and Up panel, like, judging by the Genericon crowd, I don't think half of them knew what Seinen means.
That might be true.
They probably knew Shonen.
But I was there.
Yeah.
And I know what it means, and I wanted to hear the lecture.
All right. It gave a similar... Well, not the same, but a similar panel at Manga Next where he talked about just different manga publishers, which is something he's been, like, researching a lot for a possible book. Mm-hmm. And, like, he has one really great slide of, like, the logos of a bunch of publishers. And he's just, like, tells you about all of them. And they're none of them, like, ones I've ever heard of. Some of them have amusing logos, like with a crocodile in it.
Yeah.
But it is a lot of information for one slide. But really fascinating stuff. And I think he kind of goes into that in Seinen Up. But he really also starts from, like, the beginning of manga. Like, thousands of years ago. Scrolls by Buddhist monks. And then goes from there. So I think the recording will cut off before he actually gets to talking about Seinen.
What, really?
I think so.
Oh, so you only recorded half of the panel?
We had to leave.
Oh, my God. I thought you let the thing run.
No, I took it to
go. This is even a fake episode.
It's a triple fake episode.
This is not even the entire panel.
No, I'm sorry.
What are you doing?
I'm using all the recordings that I have on hand.
Ah, cheap.
we here at Ninja Consultants like to call it thrifty.
All right. Thanks for showing up. This is the Seinen Manga panel. My name is Ed Chavez. I'm the marketing director at Vertical Link, but today I'm not. Exactly holding those responsibilities, I'm here to discuss something that's really dear to me, and I think if you, for the few of you who actually know me, as I go through this presentation, you'll possibly end up picking up a lot of little details about my personal tastes in manga, my licensing decisions over the last few years, and also maybe some more background on why I feel that seinen manga is so approachable and so appropriate for the American market. As the PowerPoint says, this morning we'll be seinening up. If you're not familiar with the term seinen, there are actually two ways to write it, and they both have pretty much the same meaning, but unfortunately the kanji are slightly different. Most people know seinen, at least the seinen that's brought over here, as the kanji for youth and age. That's just adolescent, essentially, is what that means. There's another one that is matured and then years. That's also pronounced seinen. It's a bad homonym, but you'll often see that seinen on items that are clearly 18 and up. And we'll discuss that a little bit today, but I won't go into too much detail about that. They both mean the exact same thing, but one is kind of used as an indicator for things that are appropriate for anybody who is somewhat mentally mature, and the other one is more, this is like clearly adult, and we're not necessarily going to card you, but just be aware that we shouldn't be selling this to minors. And in many cases nowadays, because those lines are getting blurrier and more blurry, you do see a lot more actual 18-up stickers on or labels on books and DVDs and such. So more and more seinen is just becoming one word. And I try to use that quite often myself when describing the term. In this presentation, we'll be talking a lot about publishers, maybe much more so than actual artists. There's just too many artists. Seinen covers a lot. And actually, even though the subtitle is The Last 40 Years of Manly Manga for Manly Men and the Women Who Love Them, we'll be going back more than a century to the history of comics. Back when comics weren't exactly what we see today, or weren't even comics per se. They were more just little art pieces that were bought and traded around. But the publishers that you see up here right now, Futabasa, Shogakukan, Daitosha, Takeshibo, Inner Brain Comics. I selected these guys because they all bring a different element to seinen. Some of them are extremely important to the to that market sector. I wouldn't necessarily say this is a genre or like specific demographic, but I also won't necessarily devote too much time to most of these either. If you're familiar with these brand names, this is just a good range of what they do. So you've got traditional publishing, Shogakukan up top. You've got one of the oldest comic publishers that still exists, Daitosha. They've been around since around 1905. Takeshi Obo, who just does like soft porn, inner brain, alt comics, Kilsan Communications. They bring over Korean comics as well as like fantasy based porn. Media Works, mainly Media Mix titles, Comix. They took what some people call neo shonen titles and adapted them for a seinen audience, which is a good evolution, I think. And that walking crocodile right there, that's a softcore porn publisher. So I've done some panels in the past about manga publishers. This doesn't necessarily cover all of them right here, but I just wanted to give you a good perspective of how, you know, just how many there are out there, and this maybe covers a fourth of them. Compared to the American market, it's just so much more broad, and each one of these publishers does, you know, they have their own little niche, or, you know, in the case of the guys way up top, they do much more than just comics. Out of those publishers that you see here, here are the ones that also do seinen. So as you see, it's not that much of a change. Like, almost all of them do seinen. That's not the case for shonen and shoujo, and definitely not the case for josei as well. And, seinen is just, it is such a big part of the market, mainly because anybody who is looking for printed entertainment, that's one of the most affordable, most portable, most accessible formats that you can pick up. And a lot of these publishers are also some of the oldest publishers around, and they take tremendous pride in the fact that they're able to do seinen, because it does take some different type of editorial and programming ideals to make it work out. The origins of seinen, as I said previously, seinen might not necessarily be from what you might think of comics. This is an ukiyo-e from Hokusai called Octopi and Pearl Diver. If you're familiar with ukiyo-e, they're essentially paintings that were sold in bookstores and kind of public stations of travel. They were used for all sorts of purposes. A lot of them focused on just the mundane. Some of them were used for travel guides. Others focused on popular sports athletes. As you'll see in a bit, some of them focused on more contemporary themes. They were kind of used sometimes as like a visual newspaper. And occasionally, as this was, they're collected into anthologies, sometimes with a lot of text, sometimes with very, very little there. But there usually is like a visual narrative there. And for the most part, the people who were buying these woodblock prints, they were men in their 20s and 30s, maybe late teens as well, essentially laborers, because they couldn't afford to actually get actual portraits and paintings for their homes. So this is the next best thing. And it also covered in a lot of contemporary culture. So, if you wanted to have a shunga and you're a single male, or maybe you just didn't really care, you might have stuff like this in your opening your little four tatami apartment. If not, you might want to have something more approachable, like the painting up top, the ukiyo up top, which is Fuji as seen by Harajuku. Now, Harajuku has obviously changed quite a bit, but as I said, very, very mundane situation sometimes. In this case, rice farming. I wouldn't necessarily associate that at all with Harajuku now, but such were the times. Right down here in the bottom, you see Kobayashi Kirakichi, who really focused almost all of his works on military themes, particularly the Russian-Japanese War. So, why would you want to have something like this up at home? Obviously, young adults have different interests that they're in. Maybe this isn't something that you would like to frame and display if we were to do something like that. This might be just something that would keep you informed about what's going on. But there are also other things. And you'll notice that a lot of these themes you still see in seinen manga today. So, train disaster, cats playing. These themes, they're just so consistent. You'll run into them all the time. Now, as I said, this isn't necessarily high entertainment. I'm not sure if they got the bang for the yen at the time, but I think the people who are purchasing these things were also they didn't have as many distractions as we have right now, so it wasn't, their options were relatively limited unless, they had the money to go see a theater a presentation or, let's see, what else was there? Well, there was work to do, so sports weren't quite as developed enough. There were, you'll see a lot of ukiyo-e of sumo and of kendo was just being developed around that time, judo was just being taught, the laws were just being developed around that time, so the average person couldn't just go to a sumo match. And when bromides came up a little later, I'm not going to talk about them, but these are more even more mass-produced than ukiyo-e. Yeah, if you went to see a theater performance, just a regular theater performance, that's not Japanese based, those are sold by the hundreds. And essentially, large-sized baseball cards are also really popular. And that also, that's those are derivatives of these football cards.
Did they do any piece of, mythology or,
To an extent, but not as much. You do end up seeing mythological situations, specifically from certain artists. A lot of the artists didn't necessarily cross over too much into other genres. What's interesting is that Kobayashi, the guy down here, he also did this cat one. So he's one of the more fascinating ukiyo-e artists. So if you're interested in that, let me know, and I can give you more information for you, free to look up his work. But this guy had plenty of time on his hands to do other things, because Japan wasn't necessarily a warring country until the ukiyo-e period started to slow down. From art to comics. Actual Japanese comics were heavily inspired by, and what I mean by comics is getting this form of panels and actually seeing dialogue with images was introduced by, obviously by the West. So, these comics are often printed in newspapers, whether in England or France or the Americas. And eventually, after major reforms, people started traveling a bit and ended up bringing back a lot of the culture they ended up seeing. And comics was just something that they were really fascinated by. Initially, they were kind of just translating works from overseas. Punch and Judy is a good example. And for a while, a lot of foreigners that would come to Japan would also, if they were journalists, they would also make little comics about the country. Some of them were, I guess people would possibly consider them racist nowadays, but one of the original actual comics published in Japan was a Australian English publication called the Yokohama Punch, and you just have this Japanese person, super caricatured, wearing kimono, standing in front of Yokohama, and there's not very friendly imagery around them. And people weren't necessarily sure about the format at the time. They just knew that they really enjoyed the stories. So eventually they ended up utilizing a lot of the same art techniques. And you can see some of that in Nakaten's work right here. This is actually about making comics in Japan. And if you look at some of the panels, one of the artists in this circle, he's actually the editor of this group. He has this henu moji design in his face, which you still see in manga and anime today. This is actually the first time that was actually ever published. He ends up walking away, and obviously his staff members are like, you know, whatever the fuck you're saying, we're just going to draw. And actually, the cool thing about this is that it actually even goes into detail about why this joke works visually. It's, Lankuten ended up being a very interesting person in this era because he actually really worked hard to try to create a culture for comics. He was a critic, he was a journalist, he was one of the more influential people of the time. And what was interesting is because these were run in newspapers and literary magazines, again, in Japan, that a lot of people kind of considered comics for a while to be a form of high art, mainly because of its origins. And that ends up kind of getting broken down by Lankuten's like disciples. Around this time, the first cycle of Japanese tankobon was published. I don't have any images of it, but if anybody wants to take notes, it's called The So-So Trip in Kamakura's Enoshima. And it was published in Maru Maru Chinbun magazine. So essentially, really round, really amazing, but rare things magazine. As I said, newspapers were very important to the original distribution of manga in Japan. So the manga times were something that really getting comics to people on a national level in the early part of the 20th century. And actually, the funny thing about Jiji manga is that there were more people that were buying the newspaper that these ran in for the comics and for anything else. They ended up, Jiji ended up becoming so powerful in Japan post-World War II that they became like the AP of Japan for the longest time. They're more of a finance company now, a financial news company now, but you know, it's really funny that their origins came in just, you know, local news and comics. And same thing, these are all current events, mainly, you know, trolley cars are being introduced in Yokohama. The first fax machine was developed and designed in Germany in 1920s or so. So the way that the Japanese visualized the fax machine was this like telephone with a mirror on the other side, so you can actually see the images. And over here, in sort of the lead up of World War II, you've got, you know, political issues as well. Fat Cats and Uncle Sam and the like. What was really interesting about this is that if you're familiar with a lot of the more influential artists of manga proper, like Tezuka, a lot of these artists who work in this period, whether it was Rakuten or Okamaru Ippei, they used the star system, and this is kind of introduced right here. So, you know, they had a number of characters that they had, and these characters interacted with actual people, whether they were, you know, actors or politicians or athletes or, you know, intellectuals of the time. You would have a set of characters that would always be featured right there. So, we'll go over here. You'll see here a lot. Newspaper gags. So this is where all of a sudden we move away from almost all comics being for adults to comics all of a sudden being a little more approachable to kids. Once again, the form of distribution initially newspapers. That's just because, you know, you can just get them really cheap there. You know, most local affiliates had comics in them, so it wasn't that hard to have a serial from Tokyo be available in Osaka or some other part of the country. Later on, when actual tankobon and actual books or graphic novels are being released, that becomes a bigger issue of distribution, and you do get like a different type of culture there. But we'll go into a little more detail about that. So one of the older ones, Ujan, or Lucky, his name is actually Fukuichi, so ingrained in Japanese culture that he is the mascot of Waseda University, so I guess he's like the mascot of Yale. But he started off as a comic book character in a newspaper. Ran from 1937 to 1971 daily, and for a good part of that, there were two issues, in the morning issue and the evening issue. So much demand for Fuku. So Zaza-san is another title that covering Japanese culture day to day. This is still, the animation for this is still going on, but the comics not so much. Simple Gags, still you can see that the origins were for adults, because a lot of the jokes themselves may go over the children, the minds of children, but visually, it's definitely skewing younger. At the same time, there were also like Salaryman comics that were coming up around that time. These Salaryman comics, same formula as Sadai-san, characters were clearly older, jokes were definitely a little more refined, but visually, like really silly, really humorous, a lot of slapstick. So he's a lot more approachable to children. Candy comics. Now, this isn't necessarily seinen at all, but I'm just kind of trying to show that there was a little bit of a split in tracks for comic distribution for a while. And some of these are magazines, some of these are individual books. The book on the far right is actually a translation of a French novel, like French kids novel. Shonen Kenya, you've got like adventure stories, you have like propaganda stuff by Kodansha. I'm not sure if my friends there would be happy that I'm sharing that with you guys, but it's after a while I ended up realizing that you can do certain things for children that you can't do for adults, and it's a market that during Japan's boom period before World War II, and like the 5-6 years after World War II, there was just this huge flood of kids. Why not get them involved? These things don't even necessarily be all that expensive. You can sell them at candy shops, which is what I would call candy comics. So kids will go buy a flavor stick and also get comics. And some of them had short stories in them as well. These are kind of what was available before Shonen Club was around, but that came up not too long after the Kodansha picture book, around 1940 or so. So the art style is, there's a wide range here, but at the same time, the better storytellers are also doing adult works. So their themes are a lot more sinister than people would think. And that really, really ended up becoming a powerful tool for propaganda. We're kind of skipping a little bit now. Flash forward about 10 years or so, mainly because there was a big thing called World War II, and that really ended up changing a lot in Japan. The GDH, which was the government that the Americans put in during the occupation, kind of ended up doing a lot of censoring, ended up taking up a lot of cultural materials and taking them to the States and cataloging them. There was a lot of censorship that was enforced not long after the PTA was established, and all of a sudden, like, things in comics, there was almost like a comics code in Japan. But that didn't necessarily cover things that weren't published by traditional means. And as I said earlier, distribution was an issue, particularly for for magazines and books. I mean, Japan isn't a really big country, but it's a long country, so trains can only take books and magazines so far. And in some regions of Japan, there were developed subcultures of comics, some of them called rental comics, and small communities would come together, they would develop stories, they would make their own anthologies, sometimes they would make their own graphic novels, they would sell them to small bookstores who would rent out the books on a daily or for 3 days. A couple of dimes was all you needed to pay. And you would get these edgy stories. You'd get portable entertainment. This was really popular in the Osaka area in the 50s and early 60s. That Osaka was the commerce capital of the country. That was one of the big driving forces of the economy over there. If you ever get a chance to go to the city, the way that the train system is designed, the old train system is designed, is pretty much to funnel laborers to specific parts of town to do different jobs. And all around all those spokes of the loop, essentially, it would not be uncommon to see manga shops. And actually, I think that's one of the reasons why you still see a lot of manga distribution in train stations, because, you know, these are little things you can just pick up and start to read, because your time is so valuable. And as you can see, the art designs are a little more mature now. A lot of these stories tend to be mysteries and horror titles and thrillers. There's definitely an edge here. It's almost a bit of counterculture to everything else that's been available in the past. These do take in a lot about current events, current media, and the like. But what they're also bringing in is, these are stories that are clearly for adults, and these are, you know, now they're developing narrative. They're not just, you know, telling you what is happening today. I mean, they're making stories. A lot of these artists were inspired by film from the West, whether it was from America or Europe, and you know, they thought that you know, the comics medium could allow them to make those same stories, but also present them in a way that you know, they can expand on what film can do as well. And from here on out, you'll start seeing a lot of those visual jokes that were, you know, created in those newspaper comics, they're now being expanded even more. So here is some character art from a couple of these anthologies that we just saw. Tatsumi was actually, if you guys are familiar with one of the Gekiga fathers, I guess. Tatsumi's Drifting Life and some of his other collections have been published in the States. And he was featured prominently, particularly in the Osaka scene. Actual character art, maybe not as dark or as clean or as realistic as what you would see on the covers. These people didn't have like a marketing backbone. They didn't have publishers, like established publishers, to help them, because these are rental comics. They're just kind of making X amount. You know, those print runs would just be it for the most part. So, you know, try to make sure that the books are attractive to sell enough initially, or to be rented. You know, while the art inside might not be as bombastic, you know, the stories are definitely very different. And that was kind of something that was consistent with a lot of these artists. And I think the more people get to see, like, the old Gekiga translated over here, I think a lot of people will kind of be surprised by that juxtaposition, just because, you know, these people were being inspired by, you know, gag comics. They were being inspired by Tezuka. They were being inspired by newspaper comics and kid comics. This is what was dominating the market when they were growing up. So it's going to take them a little bit of time to start developing their own art styles. But it does happen. you know, Janet Joy is one of the books that I showed a little while ago. You know, the designs are a little different here. There's a lot more play, more playing with shadow as well. The Thief Bastard down here at the bottom left. Also, it's getting closer to Sanen and to the Gekiga that people seem to like more now here in the States. But this is a transition that takes a little bit of time. But there are a lot of well-known authors that are that were also in the Gekiga movement and in the rental manga movement. So Mizuki Shigeru, this is Akuma-kun, so you know, little boy Akuma. Gosaki Kojima, so if you are aware of Lomofun Cub, that's the author, I mean, that's the artist. I guess you can kind of say he's the author as well, but don't tell Daryl Surratt. But actually, he's a really interesting guy. He started off working in the rental comics period. He was also doing Kamishibai, which were kind of like slideshows with a narrator. And he ended up doing that for a long time. Apparently, he was still like drawing some of those things through the 70s, even after like the Kamishibai world had completely collapsed. There was like no market, but he was still kind of doing that stuff. Ryuichi Ikegami, Crying Freeman, that's actually his very first comic up there, the rental comic. Kazuo Koike, most people might not think of like Koike being a shoujo artist, but he started off doing shoujo rental comics. So yeah,
that scares me.
But I mean, it's the more you know about Japanese horror, like a lot of the majority is made for women. So the majority is in the josei category, and a lot of that is inspired by Umezu. So yeah, Umezu is creeping the crap out of little kids, even way back then. So yeah, Gekiga 2.0, maybe. Some people call Garo like the first seinen magazine. Some people call Garo like the first alternative magazine. A lot of Gekiga artists, and a lot of rental comics artists, drew for Garo. And initially, you know, Sanpei Shirata, who was one of the driving forces behind Garo, he really wanted that to be like a home for those artists. Like even if they were living like in Osaka or Kyushu, Hokkaido, as long as they were able to bring this stuff up, they would be able to you know, have a place to be published. And it, you know, wouldn't necessarily compete with all the other more established publishers, but they wouldn't necessarily have to worry too much about limited runs and only having distribution in their small communities. Now that they can have this place to work for and actually be paid, and maybe, you know, if their books come out, maybe make a decent, like, stable living. You know, one of the things about Garo is that its fundamentals are definitely in the rental manga and Gekiga, so, you know, payments were an issue, and even until recently when Garo closed up shop in 2002, if you did work for Garo, you didn't get paid until the books come out, and there was never a guarantee for books to be published. But a number of artists that are extremely important drew for Garo. Ryuichi Ikegami, which we talked about a little earlier, Shirata Sanpei, Mitaro Suge, who like did some really revolutionary work that I'm not necessarily sure is exactly Gekiga. I was kind of thinking, I consider it more like alternative comics, and maybe not even comics at all, but or the way people would possibly consider them. He was an early adapter there. Mizuki Shigeru, as we mentioned before. Moving on, like Erika Sakurazawa, one of the better known names of josei, Nan Kiriko is another. To, you know, more modern artists like Tori Miki, Usumaru Furuya, Mori Masayuki. So you've got Lychee, and you've got Mori Masayuki. He's like a guy who just look at Holy Land, don't necessarily, Sabe, who was in Robot quite a bit. You know, these are names that you might not necessarily associate with Gekiga, but as Garo ended up continuing for the 4 decades that it was published, it became more of an alt comics source. And yeah, you can see, you can clearly see that in the designs for their covers. Previously, something that looks like it should be like a Gekiga title. This is issue number 3 from 1964. And all of a sudden, it gets to be pretty avant-garde at times. Sometimes emulating what's cool in art at the time, but not even in comics at all. But, it is a visual medium, so, why not represent that? Garo just continues to evolve for the decades that it was available. And even now, as Axe, you never know what to expect from the Saiyan Do, Saiyan Kagosha crew. So Garo, that was like the early 60s when it started off. By this time, magazines, there was a proliferation of them. There were tons and tons of manga publishers, hundreds of them. Some of them were doing rental comics, some of them were doing more mainstream distribution. The majority of the more mainstream publishers that were just focusing on things like shonen and experimenting with shoujo, but they ended up realizing that not only were their readership maturing, but also their artists were maturing quite a bit. They couldn't necessarily keep some of the stories that were in these shonen titles in these magazines because of issues like the PTA and such. They didn't want this industry to be all that restricted. So what they ended up doing was developing some new demographics, essentially, some new markets. And Seinen was something that was developed not long after Garo. And mind you, Garo wasn't necessarily like a huge, huge hit, but it was definitely on editors' minds and publishers' minds. And the authors that worked in early Seinen ended up coming back and forth and back and forth was in between those worlds. That's still the case to this day, but I think things are becoming a little more... There seems to be a clearer line now on what is going to cross over or not. But as you see, also, you have Shotaro Ishinomori, a guy that is so critical in popular early shonen, now moving on to something that is obviously for adults. I mean, he's not trying to hide that there. Monkey Punch, action and girls. And Futabasha manga action, they were the earliest of adapters. They were releasing other comics at the time. They tried to do a shonen anthology. Didn't necessarily take off. The big boys had really dominated that sector. They were holding around like 80% of the market. These guys thought, why not go in a direction that's kind of like Garo, but not quite as experimental or as extreme. We can also use this talent pool that's here, and they're willing to work within our structure. Yeah, so they were able to work with some of some no names like Tetsuo Saito or Kojima Goseki, as we mentioned before, and Action, early publishers of Koika Kazuo. And then other magazines that are coming along, these are all other early seinen magazines. You see a little bit of the sexy, a little bit of the mundane that we were talking about in early seinen. You've got Play Comic from Akira Shoten, with Captain Harlock right up there. You've got Leiji Matsumoto on top of Manga Goraku. That's actually that magazine to this day is one of the more consistent selling seinen manga magazines. and you have big comics. I mean, and just as, you know, Shogakukan being as powerful as they were at the time, on the cover itself, it's like comics for men. We've made comics for kids for the longest time. Now you guys, you older guys, who've been, you know, sticking out with us since you were reading second grade, third grade, fourth grade, and, you know, Shonen Sunday, and now you have your own adult magazine. I mean, there were, you know, in the boom, the first boom of Seinen, you know, a lot of artists that you might be very familiar with, Azuma Hideo, you know, kind of feeling his oats right there, working on Lolicon way back when. Ishinomori, you got Tezuka. I mean, even in the packaging, whether, you know, you do have things that are really sexy or just like a drama, in the case of Murakami Kazuo's work over there, very different designs from what you would see from Shonen titles. I mean, they clearly wanted people to know that they had matured. And, you know, not all of these are, you know, like extremely, you know, intellectual works. I mean, they were, you know, these publishers and editors were clearly aware that this is just entertainment, and things need to be accessible and fun. So, you know, you did have things like Lee Ultrashi, you know, just, you know, your ideal woman. You had like Detective Boob, or Detective Pie over here, but really tanned, busty detective in Shinjuku. And that's around the time that Shinjuku was actually like Sinjuku. I'm not sure exactly where Tezuka was going with that cover of Human Insects, but I would love to be able to replicate that for the English version. Yeah, and then, like I said at the very start, there are two ways to read Seinen, so there are two different kanji for Seinen. And around the 70s, around this Seinen manga boom, you do get this like split. Now there is, for the three of you that are here, there is a little bit of a quiz right here. One of these magazines, one of these issues was not published in the 70s. Can anybody guess which one? I think it's pretty obvious. Yeah. Yeah, it's the one on the far right. I think the easy way to figure that out is maybe, but the price point as well. And the other ones are just like 180 yen, 150 yen. And the funny thing about this is two of these publications still exist. And if you say Gekiga to your average manga reader in Japan, this is what they think when you say Gekiga at first. There's a specific like hyper-realism style of art that is involved in this type of Ero Gekiga is what people used to call it. And that is still used to this day. There's a blog that I follow on a daily basis, and they update on magazines like Sunday and Manga Lawrence and Manga Goraku, which had the Leiji Matsumoto cover. Their star fell relatively quickly. But those guys are still doing the style of Gekiga to this day, and their numbers are extremely, extremely consistent. It's almost as if those readers have been reading those magazines for the last 30, 40 years. And it's very likely that they have been. They might be the only people reading these magazines for those years. These are also the things that you would find that you don't normally find in like bookstores or comic shops. You have to go to specific places to find these things. If you have an idea or if you've heard about convenience store comics, in their 18 and up section, this is basically what you see there, outside of some like more anime-inspired stuff. Then in the 80s, you know, the seinen sector really ended up like blowing up. Mind you, manga in general it's going through what people thought was the golden age. At this point, readership, like manga sales had passed, I think it was around 300 million units per year. Magazine sales were through the roof. A number of the shonen magazines had regular readerships, regular circulations of more than a million now. So manga had definitely been established as an entertainment medium, and the seinen section started to grow at a really, really rapid rate. And like the major publishers who were just kind of dabbling in this now were trying to completely capitalize on this. Obviously, this is kind of tied into Japan's economic boom as well, and these publishers had a little bit more money to throw around. But what was interesting is that during the oil crisis of like the mid to late 70s, a lot of people thought that that was going to impact manga because it impacted so many other elements of entertainment and publishing, and other segments of finance. But there was no significant drop in manga at the time. It was only like a drop in overall sales of like a few 10,000 units, which was kind of shocking. So at that, once they realized that they were able to weather that storm, the industry was like, all right, let's just go all out. They developed more and more seinen manga magazines. Josei ended up coming in online, being published. More Ero manga was being done. Just an example of the seinen publications that were around, just from like 1978 and then to the late 80s. Young Jump, where Akira, Young Magazine. Akira was published. Young Jump by Shueisha. Spirits, which, as I said at the start, like this is where like I started reading manga. So this is these magazines are really close to my heart. I had a subscription to the Spirits for like 15 years at one point. Morning, with the tagline of like, read these comics and you will become Genki. Business Jump, Salaryman. Now I had to, it wasn't enough if they were just reading edgy titles. Now they had to have like specific titles specifically for them. Salaryman, Kintaro was a property that was predominantly in there. Afternoon. So I think now seinen is starting to become a little more avant-garde as well. Champion. This is possibly like one of the few covers of Champion that does not have boobs on them. We'll see a little bit more of that later. Young Animal, Miura, the guy who did Berserk, drawing manly men even back then. All of a sudden, young adults, they had stories. And the seinen market, because it was being developed around the same time as the Josei market, they weren't shy about being able to incorporate the guys and the gals as well. A lot of females drawing, and a very strong female readership. And just like I mentioned at the very start, you have a little bit of everything from the mundane to the exciting to the political. You've got believers. You have another. I think at the start I showed you guys a comic about comic making. You have the King of Editors up there, Tokyo University Stories. You have Naoko, which is just about long distance cross country running, Omrice, family, single sisters, and her brother in there, and Mason Ikoku, from some no name artist named Mariko Takahashi. So seinen kind of ends up progressing through the 80s, inspiring a lot of media in a number of ways. I could have like added in a slide about media mix and how that ended up inspiring a lot of anime, and that was really critical to the animation boom and the OVA boom, even in the West. But I'm not an anime fan, and that's not necessarily my forte. So just be aware that a lot of the stuff that you guys might have been introduced to, whether it was on TV or eventually by DVD. For a while, a good number of that stuff came out of Seinen. And Seinen magazines took an inspiration from TV magazine, which was published for Shonen kids back in the 60s, I think, in the 70s. And they started making Media Mix only magazines. So these are magazines that were essentially based around like whole properties, animation property. That same animation would have a manga, it would have a light novel, it would have a video game, or dildos made out of them. So there was this big production element. I'm not necessarily touching on that. Instead, I'm moving forward about 15 years to something that you start seeing nowadays. And once again, we're going through another boom of seinen. Right now, the Japanese manga market is it reached a peak around the start of this century, and it is on a slow decline. That decline, a lot of analysts feel, is going to be a big decline in the next 5 to 10 years because of population issues. But where that's really impacting is mainly the shonen market. Like the shoujo market is almost entirely destroyed right now. But the shonen market is really feeling a pinch. Seinen, on the other hand, is flourishing at this moment. While One Piece is obviously dominating sales, not far behind it are titles like Vagabond or Saint Youngman or Shimakoseku or a number of other seinen properties. And I think you're partially inspired by the fact that a number of those experimental manga from the 60s, the 70s, the early 80s kind of shut down once the economy and just the market started to, the manga market started to shrink. A lot of the major publishers or the established publishers ended up picking up the slack. They ended up kind of taking on some of these ideas of not only being experimental, but just like going into like way, way different genres and formats of narrative. Henzemi is a great example. The juxtaposition of the story and the art. Like, you possibly think this is like a moe title. This is the furthest thing from a moe title. It was extremely, extremely disturbing and genius at the same time. That is kind of what that's a type of new way of thinking, new way of storytelling that I feel that Garo had way back then. And you do see some crazy art in Morning Two and Axe, the modern day Axe, Ikki and the like. So a little bit of both, a little bit of the experimental, a little bit of this new form of visual storytelling. But at the same time, they're not like forgetting that seinen is for adults, and all the titles up top, they're all serialized in the same imprint, which is Morning. And I think I've mentioned this way too many times, but pet comics, comics about girls doing girly things, essentially having pillow fights almost every day time. The other one is about two guys, and they're not always talking about their cat, but the cat is a major character in that series, which is drawn by a Spanish Irani Japanese, Sarah Inez. And then you have Pipachu, which is not exactly manga, not exactly comics. It's its own little thing. And then, yeah, I mean, Jesus, and I mean, you don't, we're not even seeing, you know, manga on here, you know, by two of manga's most influential critics and creators. You know, and finding different ways to sell things, finding ways to, you know, maintain audiences the best way you can. You know, Seinen right now, I think they're, it's got some of the better minds behind it, whether it's marketing or editorial or just artistic talent. And, you know, now we're getting into Seinen that is, like, really experimental, you know, erotics, you know, which you would think would be nothing but porno, but it's, you know, actually not. I mean, that's Aoi Hana on the cover. Gelatin, full color. These are hentai titles, but hentai. These are works by hentai artists that are doing seinen titles now. And Axe. Once again, you know, why bother with showing the comics on there? Neither Comic Q or Axe care. They know that their readership are going to show up the comics. So we can have Mrs. Driller on there. We can have, you know, my uncle and his best cowboy. And yeah, that's about it. You know, Seinen is an interesting part of the market right now. It's the only, well, that and four panel comics right now is the only, they're the only the only sectors of the manga market that have actually been growing over the last 5 years. Almost all of the seinen manga pubs have been working on adding more magazines to their lineup right now, and it's really strange because I mean the numbers just don't necessarily, the numbers for the industry as a whole just don't necessarily support that much growth. But instead, what they're doing, as you see with these magazines that are up here right now, is they're developing further niches, and Seinen has a ton of that. I mean, that was initially thought up you know, for the Media Mix development in the late 80s and early 90s, but they kind of took that to even further extremes. I mean, I didn't discuss this, but, you know, there are specific magazines for hobbies and sports, politics, you know, instructional works and the like. So, you know, comics, anthologies that are drawn exclusively by women for, you know, seinen women readers. There's just so much confidence in this because they have the readership base. People read these comics to begin with. You know, everybody understands the language of manga now. It's been around for more than 100 years. Now they just have to try to find, they're working on finding new ways to keep those readers and keep those readers engaged. And by creating these additional, you know, micro niche publications, you know, they're satisfying the demand for a lot of these readers. Yeah.
I've been interested in it seems like there's a decent number of artists doing stuff at seinen publications who are artists who would generally have done shoujo stuff or who were doing, like, even boys' love manga. Is that because of, like, a sizable female audience for the seinen publications?
I mean, as I just briefly touched on this, but the shoujo market has just been something that has been in flux for a long time. There isn't a lot of, like, not until like the Lenai stuff started to appear in, like, Shokami and, like, Cheese and those, like, spin-offs that Shogakukan made. Like, the only places people could get, like, additional work in shoujo was doing, like, Harlequin work. So, or doing BL, which has been growing recently. So, you know, some of these artists, they just want to get work. Some of them do want to develop their crafts and there isn't that much editorial influence in Lowa's shoujo. And particularly once you get down really low, like Nakayoshi and, you know, Ribbon and stuff. So, like for little girls, it's funny. A lot of artists, particularly if they do work for mainstream publishers, they don't necessarily fear getting editorial direction as much as they actually like the structure. You know, obviously they also get paid more, and work is a lot more stable. And when you're working in a seinen magazine, you also have just much more work to begin with, instead of, you know, doing 20 pages a month and, you know, or 30 pages a month and having to pay the same number of assistants. So, you know, all of a sudden you might get paid a lot more and not have to have your mom help you out. Or if your mom is helping, then there's more. And the funny thing is that a lot of times, like those artists don't necessarily go back to where they originated from.
Yoshinami is only really doing.
She's basically just doing seinen right now. And even, I mean, this isn't an example of a person who went to seinen, but even Yazawa Ai, you know, she started off doing like traditional shoujo, and she worked with like a more like indie josei magazine. Came back, and she was like, "Nah, this is just going to be like higher shoujo kind of josei." So. While, you know, the numbers might not be quite there for Joseph, if she's working for a big publisher, the distribution's going to be just as good. So,
yeah.
Any other questions at all?
Good question.
Yeah.
Maybe you covered in the beginning, but on the international market, how does it really compare?
You know, that's really funny, because a lot of what was released initially in America, I mean, obviously there was, you know, Barefoot Gen a long time ago, and that's technically shonen, but, you know, the stuff that, you know, Clips and Dark Horse would eventually release, and eventually Viz would, like, co-produce, initially most of that was almost all seinen. And, you know, that made sense, because, you know, the comic industry here is so tied to, you know, older readers. That ended up changing with, like, a manga revolution, where things, you know, went to like the furthest extreme, down to, you know, a shoujo focus. And it's funny right now, with the manga market here kind of like collapsing on itself, but seinen publishers like Dark Horse, like Vertical, they're doing relatively well for them. There's actual, like, at least unit and sales wise, there's actual growth right now. Maybe it's because the readership is mature. I'm not necessarily.
I think
there's that as well. I mean, after a certain amount of time, there's like vendor confidence. But at the same time, I mean, there's the shelves still are dominated by like Shonen Jump titles and, you know, Shoujo titles. So I think, just like the Japanese felt, you know, these readers are going to be there, no matter what. They're capable of spending money on this content. If you have like specific niches to satisfy their many interests, even better. I think publishers here are figuring that out now, and I think some of them are doing things to what maybe the readership might feel to be extremes. I mean, I don't necessarily think it's fair for Drawn and Quarterly to call all of their manga gekiga, when that might not be even what the artists want, or for Viz to call some of their alternative comics, or like just like older shonen comics, like seinen, or just put them under a Sigiki line, because that would work better. I mean, the Japanese are like, how could you call this, it's got all the tropes of a shonen title, but it works. You know, we're a different market. We have different sensibilities, and you know, if those are the steps needed to take to sell the books, I think they need to be done. And you know, some publishers are willing to take more risks. Like I said, with like joining Quarterly, and like we still flip some of our books just because some people can't read things flipped. So I mean, unflipped. So yeah, I'm really curious to see where that ends up going, particularly since now Tokyopop's going to be distributed again by Dark Horse, to see if they have been licensing a little more seinen recently, which is kind of curious, and that's not their base. And they actually haven't been licensing like good seinen titles, so I wonder if they're going to continue to do that, or if they're just going to like finally kick the bucket.
Is it the same? Is it the same with France right now? Because I know France is the other really big market. You know, if we kind of, that's the comparison.
Right. Yeah, in France, like the seinen market has been established for a long time, and there are like manga culture is.
Oh, yeah.
It's pretty established for a while.
But if you see it in France and something bombs, you know, for some reason, then you know.
And at the same time, very few seinen titles do actually like extremely well in France.
Yeah.
I've been able to see like some sales figures. And the funny thing about the French market, and a lot of people don't talk about this, is that they are also starting to their market size is contracting. They're not publicly saying that. And what is one thing that has been selling surprisingly well in France right now has been Fist of the North Star. They just did a reprint of that, and that's been like a big, big seller.
I have some questions about the rental comics.
Yeah.
First, were there not, like, I don't know how Japan works, but were there not libraries? Because, you know, that manga...
Oh, yeah, but manga is still not available in libraries. Still not, I mean, books that you have to have in libraries, Barefoot Gin, you have to have, like, Tezuka there. You might have, like, a Hagio. I'm sorry?
Ashinojo?
Yeah, maybe not. I don't think people think, like, look at Ashinojo for the educational elements of it. They might have, like, if there's going to be like a Yokoyama, it might be Comet or Sayuki. More like a Sayuki because of the, you know, that is fiction, yeah, and traditional like Chinese culture. You just don't see it shelved. I mean, I've talked to Yanni about this a lot when he was a kid, because he went to a Westerner school, being half Japanese and half Greek. His parents wanted him to read English, kind of like me, and he would only get to read manga out of the library until he was a teen, and then he, you know, had money to spend. And that's why he's obsessed with Tezuka, because that's the only comic they had. They only had Tezuka comics, and up until very recently. Even libraries in Japan only wanted those comics in their libraries, because if you were starting to put other things in them, there was also like a shoujo library in Osaka that was kind of popular. They expanded it into Josei and then BL, and that's been shut down. So.
And my other question regarding that, these early rental comics, were they really expensive? Or did you just
no, they were.
Buy books?
Okay, yeah, it was. Yeah, I mean, they were rentals. You had to bring them back.
But I mean, could you not buy them, or you could?
I mean, if you bought them, I mean, if you bought them, you were stealing.
So they weren't available, like, to purchase.
That wasn't their purpose, because the majority of rental comics never got to see a reprint, and their runs were at the most maybe around, you know, a couple, like 30,000 or so. And these are for like established anthologies with like the cream of the crop. And mind you, once again, those were limited, this thing just died. Those were limited distribution, so that would just be in the community. If you were in Tokyo and you wanted to get that rental comic, good luck. It was most likely just in Osaka. And if you did see it, you know, that's someone who bought some copies, maybe from the publisher, like took them up to Tokyo, and they were like, okay, now we're going to rent them out over here.
How much of those comics do we have these days now?
Rental comics?
Yeah, like how much of them made it to Boston?
No, you're starting to see them again with Mandaraka now. Just in general, paper has been really bad for a lot of these comics, and they continue to be in Japan, just to maintain like prices at a relatively low rate. So they're really, really hard to find. To get like, there is one of the biggest issues with like Gegege no Kitaro, if I ever get a license, is that like not even Mizuki Pro has all the content. So you can never, there will never be a definitive Kitaro because there'll be so much loss to the on the rental manga side.
You had a slide like a couple of slides ago where it had like a whole bunch of the different seinen mangas. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I'm just interested in kind of how they divided up like their demographic.
Finish the question.
Well, I was just interested, like, you know, Young Animal, like, who are they making this for?
Mm-hmm.
Like, Young Champion, is this, like, for the kids who want to become Yakuza?
Yeah.
I think that's Champion Red.
No, that is Young Champion. Champion Red is gone, like, oh, it's, like, the really moe one, but, you know, that's actually, I've long had a personal theory that each manga publisher has a personality, and I do one of these at Manga Next, and I go into more detail about that. But Young Sunday, it's just a progression of the Shonen Sunday ideal, and Spirits takes that to another like level in a slightly different way, superior, even more mature, you know, gold, big comic gold, even more mature. But that line starts off from the beginning of readership, from the shonen side, and then progresses up. In the case of Animal, Hakusensho was releasing some shonen. Outlanders is an example in like the 80s, but they were, you know, they were a spin-off of Shueisha and Shogakukan, so the whole concept of Hakusensho was just trying to make different comics, and Animal is exactly what you would expect. I mean, this is wild stuff, and like their monthly version, Arashi, I mean Storm, crazier and crazier, just trying to just tear up other people's ideas of what the young sector is, like young, that little demographic. It was, I mean, you know, kids in their late teens and they're in college and.
So is there like an anthropomorphization of like manga anthology?
The funny thing about that is if you looked at those, a lot of those are first issues for those magazines. They all have like their mascots on there.
Right.
They're all, I mean, you can do that with those mascots, but they're all like different levels. Like the shonen mascots outside of the Jump Pirate, they're kind of cute and, you know, innocent-ish. Once you start getting to like the grizzled, you know, bulldog and like the really horny like rat and you know, the alligator with the stovetop cap and his cane. I mean, you start, the nuance is there where you're like, all right, so this is not kind of for kids.
Okay.
So where does the division, like, I don't know exactly how Japanese market divides itself, but like anti-manga anthologies,
mm-hmm.
is that considered seinen?
Yeah, I mean, it is seinen, but as, well, you weren't here at the very beginning, but they're seinen, but the kanji is just different. And nowadays, people just toss around, like, and even more so now after, like, that law was, like, enacted or passed, they're just tossing around the concept of, like, this is all seinen. This is all adult. Now, is my seinen 18 and up? Well, you know, I guess now you're going to have to tell me, because we were regulating ourselves in the past. If most of the content is obviously just sexual or extreme, nothing but violence, will it be in an Arrow manga magazine? Yeah. But if there's some sort of, like, if there is some sort of narrative and you do have like sex and violence. This is mature. People should be able to comprehend that, you know, if you're capable adults, that this is not reality. And now people are really just publishers are just saying this is just this is all.
To fight to the top, so we can know your